Hey, I'm Zale, host of Preconceived, a podcast that challenges the preconceptions that shape how we view the world. Preconceived examines both our approach to major life choices, but also our perspectives on issues to which we may have been overly conditioned towards certain opinions. Each episode features a different topic, with experts, researchers, and luminaries in their respective fields. We think you will especially enjoy recent episodes on polyamory, regretting parenthood, dopamine nation, and myths of the beauty industry. Find Preconceived wherever you get your podcasts.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, my loves. Welcome back to Turn Me On Podcast. This week, Jeremy and I spoke with our new friend, Dr. Deborah. Dr. Deborah Mandel is a nationally renowned psychologist with over 30 years of experience, and she's written over 4 books, including some very catchy titles like Dump That Chump. But her newest book is the one that we focus on mostly today in today's conversation. It's called Sassy and Rude, Her New Attitude, a tough love guide for moms on how to bring back the sugar and spice in their not-so-nice adult daughters. And it sounds really fun, and we do talk about a lot of really interesting things between mother and daughter dynamics, all that fall within this realm of trying to make our relationships better. You're going to love this conversation. This was a very sweet guest to have today, and we really enjoyed it. We hope you do too. Thank you so much for listening.
Okay, super exciting. We are joined by our new friend, Dr. Deborah. And if you are not aware, Dr. Deborah Mandel is a nationally renowned psychologist with over 30 years of experience, which brings her no-nonsense yet compassionate approach to the forefront. As the author of 4 books, including the best-selling Dump That Chump. God, I love that. I love that title, Dump That Chump. Dr. Deborah has been featured on national television and radio shows as a relationship expert. Her most recent release, Sassy and Rude, Her New Attitude, a tough love guide for moms on how to bring back the sugar and spice in their not-so-nice adult daughters, which is a book we're going to be talking about quite a bit today, I believe, which I'm really excited to dive into because parent-child relationships, parent adult child relationships is something I've been thinking about a lot recently. And so we are just absolutely thrilled to have the chance to sit here and speak with our new friend, Dr. Deborah. Thank you so much for joining us. I mean, firstly, before we get into it all, please take a moment, introduce yourself to the two of us and to all of our listeners.
I think we should just stop where you're at because it sounds so impressive.
There's so much more to you.
Okay, well, let's see. I mean, I love animals so very, very, very much. I was raised with animals, recently lost our second of our 2 kitty brothers. And it's been about a year now, but I tell you, I work from home now pretty exclusively. And my house is a little lonely without those little pitter patter of those furry friends. I miss them. So that's a big part of me in my life and working on finding some volunteer opportunities in that department. And I've had a lot of fun in my career being a psychologist, but also really branching out into this media world and being on TV and doing podcasts and writing blogs and writing books. So it's been a really full and wonderful career. And I'm really excited to share some of the things that I've learned. And I have to tell you, I'm always a work in progress and are always willing to learn more from others. So it's very exciting to be here. And I can't wait to hear some of your feedback and insights on things as well.
Yeah. I just out of curiosity, are you still a practicing psychologist?
I am. Mm-hmm. COVID definitely changed the nature of my practice. I used to be, at one point I had three offices that I went to and worked at different rehab centers in Malibu, California area. And so really gave me the freedom to work from home. And most people were very accepting of that. And I just recently gave up my office because there was really no reason to keep it. So I have a great setup at home. My husband is out and about most of the time with his work. So he's not here. So we both have our privacy, and it's a good go. And for example, I'm going to Costa Rica in a couple weeks, and I'll be there a month, and I can see my clients from there. So it really opened up the world.
I love that. And so so as a psychologist, like I mean this is kind of, this is not probably not the direction you were expecting me to take this conversation, but I'm just,
it's okay,
again,
I've got my notes.
Just out of curiosity, as a psychologist, I know that I just started seeing a therapist recently, and he's amazing. I got really lucky in that it was a sort of first meet. Immediately, like, was like, oh, this is, you know, I want this guy to be my best friend, which I know is like, that's he can't do that. But that's okay. We'll keep it professional. And I love the way that he works. I love the way that he kind of navigates me through my thoughts and stuff. But having just recently got into talk therapy and really going like full on with it, I've been just curious about all the different sort of types of psychology, and also like looking at where psychology has come from and to where it is today. So with that, I'm just curious, like, what is your modality, or, you know, what are some modalities that you've kind of gravitated towards throughout your career, and has it sort of stayed in the same lane, or have you branched out over the, you know, the number of years that you've been doing this?
So thank you. That's a great question. I'll just say that, for one, thankfully, psychology has come out of the dark ages, and it's pretty much a mainstream. And I believe that probably everybody in anyone's inner circle knows somebody who is in therapy, has been in therapy, or is in therapy themselves, which is a beautiful thing in my opinion, because it's so needed. And in the old days, people would think about therapy as only for the crazy people who cannot function in the world. Mm-hmm. And we've come such a long way from there to really make it available to people who just really want to explore themselves, have self-growth. So I work differently depending on the nature of the client who's in front of me. So I have many clients who have what I would say is more of the general life concerns, some relationship issues, things they just want to talk through. And then I have much more of a coaching style. Versus people who come with, they're mired in shame. They've had a lot of abuse in their lives. They have been either physically, sexually abused, or have been through a lot of trauma. And then I use other modalities like something called EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization reprocessing. And it's basically bilateral stimulation to the brain, which helps to unlock trauma that's lodged in an area of the brain called the amygdala. And what it does tend to do is help us create a positive relationship to ourselves in relation to the memory of something traumatic. We don't change the actual memory, we just change our relationship to it. And then there's things like tapping. I don't know if you've ever heard of tapping, which is an emotionally focused therapy orientation, and internal family systems. I was trained in Gestalt therapy, which is a lot of that empty chair, talking to the person as if they were right in front of you, writing different kinds of letters. I have a really broad focus, and I work a lot with people with depression, post-traumatic stress, people who have been abused, traumatized. And then I love, one of my favorite aspects of work is relationships and all components of that, which is what led me to write all of my four books prior to this one, Sassy and Rude, is for mothers and daughters. But I mean, all kinds of relationships, workplace relationships, first book, Healing the Sensitive Heart, which is basically your relationship with yourself, and your boss is not your mother, and Dump That Chump. I tell you a funny story about Dump That Chump. I've had two experiences now where I have been asked to change the title of my book last minute. So the original title of Dump That Chump was Chuck That Schmuck.
Oh.
Okay, yeah, I like it.
Final Hour publisher says, we can't have schmuck in the title. And I'm like, I had 24 hours to come up with new title of that. And I'm like, I want something that rhymes because that's catchy. And that's what, you know, people are find appealing.
Yeah.
So I came up with that one. And then Sassy and Rude was originally called Why Is She Such a Bitch?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. I like it. Yeah. I mean, I was thinking of like alliteration. I mean, maybe not so much rhyming, but I was like, wow, what else could you do? Like break up with that bitch. It was like dump that chump or break up with the bastard. Yeah. But I wonder why
they couldn't say schmuck on the schmuck book.
I like it. Yeah.
It's so mainstream today, right? I mean, people use it as a standard word.
Oh, yeah.
Schmuck, right?
Loser. Yeah. I could sit here for all day and do it. But yeah, I'm thank you for kind of going into the different forms of psychology that you have used and that you sort of believe in. It's funny, like I think that especially when you hear things about EMDR or tapping, there's most certainly a ton of people out there who hear something like that and they think, oh yeah, sure, I feel like that sounds like it would work. But I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that hear something like the idea of tapping or even the rapid eye movement that would think, ah, that just sounds bunk. Hey, what is that woo-woo bullshit?
My neighbor would say that's just snake oil.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And the reason why I wanted to firstly ask you that is, and especially once you brought up EMDR and the tapping, a big part of psychology reminds me of our time learning at theater school. So Brady and I met in theater school.
Oh, nice.
As trained actors. And a big part of the teaching in a conservatory style acting training program is it's not EMDR and it's not tapping, but a lot of the exercises that you do are sound very similar to those sorts of things. And to get into really wholeheartedly get into a role, it takes a certain amount of psychological effect that you need to be able to place on yourself in order to go to those places, whether it's, you know, to be like wholeheartedly emotional in a scene or to convince an audience that you are a maniacal psychopath or, you know, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And whenever I'm in therapy and we're going through these sorts of things, I'm like, God damn, this is, you know, there's, it felt silly in school and sometimes it feels silly doing it in the therapy, you know, in the therapy room, but it works. Like it really gets you into this space within your psyche that allows you to, I don't know, open up doors that maybe were at one point welded shut or just, you know, that these doors that needed just a little bit of grease to kind of allow those hinges to move a little more smoothly. And anyway, so yeah, I totally derailed the whole conversation, but I'm on a psychology kick right now, and I love it. So thank you for going down that road with me.
Absolutely, and I just want to commend both of you to have had that experience and then to bring those gifts also into this world of sharing with other people, because you do offer a richness having been able to dive into the depths of your psychology in that way, which a lot of people, as you were talking about, become very frightened to do that. Our childhoods, the way we're brought up in society says, no, you can't be that. It's one of the things I talk about in the book we get into is this whole concept of being nice. Do you know, being nice is pretending not to know. It is not about really telling your truth. And so we are often shamed into anything that we experience in our youth. And then we put those things into compartments. We lock them away somewhere. They still affect our psyche in one way or another.
Mm. What was the impetus for the book, Sassy and Rude? The mother-daughter relationship dynamic, is that something that you saw a lot through your work, or is it something that is, you know, specifically kind of tied to your own experience with a daughter? Where did this all begin for you?
So since we're not on a 2-minute segment television show where I have to condense it very intensely, I'll give you a little bit more of the in-depth version,
please.
If that's okay.
Yes.
Yeah. So part of the inspiration of this book was really I went through many trials and tribulations with my own daughter when she was a teenager and as a young adult. And I knew that that was normal because that is what girls do with their moms and is part of the developmental process. But I thought, wow, I've also worked with a lot of mother-daughter duos. And then I thought back, and my goodness, did I have a challenging relationship with my own mother that never got to get healed. My mother died when I was in my early 30s. She was only 58. And so she only got to know one of her grandkids, my sister's, my older niece, actually. But otherwise, she was one of those women who, you know, she was an immigrant. So was my dad. My father was from Poland. She was from Estonia. Father was a Holocaust survivor. Interestingly, I think they spoke 11 languages between the two of them, but none of them English. And they met in Canada, in Toronto, and they married. My mother was quite young. My father was significantly older. And I just don't think she really wanted to be a mom. Not that she didn't try to love us and do the best that she could, but she wasn't one of those very openly loving people. And nor was my dad, because he was out there literally to the bone working, you know, the 16-hour days, coming home, crashing, barely got to see him, did his best to try to make a go of having had nothing and trying to come here and bring us something. So in hindsight, I have so much appreciation and admiration for all that they did. But I would tell you, as a little child in the day-to-day, I wanted hugs. I wanted atta girls. I wanted, what a good job that you're doing. And my mom's answer to everything is, oh, straight A's on your report card. Why aren't they A pluses? Go do better type of thing. Mm-hmm. She wanted me to play the piano. I had to play classical. I wanted to play the fun things that other people play. You know, to this day, I have my baby grand piano that comes everywhere with me with all my music from childhood and all the recitals that I was in. And I look at it and go, someday you will be my friend again. So I say this not at all with any feelings of victimization or that I live in that world at all. That's a lot of what my first book was about, was how do you move from victim to survivor to thriver so that you really can be in an open forum of life as opposed to in a psychological prison. So the inspiration was threefold, basically. All the work that I did in my practice, my own work with my daughter so that we could get somewhere, and my own pain and sadness that my mother and I never really got to heal our wounds.
Yeah, I bet. Mm. That's, you know, I lost my dad, and not my mom, I lost my dad 4 years ago. And I know that it's like I've reached, not that I haven't lost other people in my life before that, because I certainly have, but it's now for the first time I'm starting to look at my mom as someone who, my mom and my stepmother, because I was raised I was raised primarily by my stepmother, but I have an adult relationship with both of these women. And to think about them, like, they could just die any day, literally any day. And
we all could.
The things I know, but like we expect that we're going to live out a certain lifespan, we know for the most part, the natural order of things is that we'll lose our parents. Mm-hmm. And so to look at the relationship and be like, what's available here, I guess, for a quality relationship and the amount of time that we have left, like, do we need to heal certain things? Like,
yeah. Well, I think that question there, do we need to heal certain things? I think you would be hard pressed to find anybody who has a relationship. And, you know, let's just stick to the relationship of like parent child relationships. I don't know anybody who couldn't find something that needs to be healed if they took the time to dig for what that could be. And the thing is that those things that quote unquote need to be healed, well, it's like trauma, it is subjective, right? So something that might be traumatic for you might not have been traumatic for me if I went through the same experience.
Right.
And so when you look at like parent child relationships or parent adult children relationships, there's things that I have heard from my peers that they went through with their parents. And when I look at it, I go, well, I don't know if that would have really actually had a a profound effect on me the way that it has on you. And also vice versa. You know, they might hear the same things from me and think the same thing. So, but I do think that, like, no matter who you are, it's a, there's a pretty good chance that there's some sort of healing that needs to happen. Because, and the reason why I feel that way is if I had a kid today, right? I'm 36. I don't have a child. When my parents had me, they were in their late 20s.
Sure.
I cannot fucking imagine having a kid in my late 20s. I can barely imagine having a kid now, and I'm almost 40. I'm coming up to 40. So, of course, your parents are going to fuck up at some point. Like, it's just
okay.
Inevitable.
No. Okay, let me be a little more specific then, and then let's let our guest,
who's a
psychologist, maybe dissect a little bit about this.
Sorry, I've been going to therapy, so now I think I'm a fucking therapist.
But like, okay, let's say specifically. Healing that has to do with, let's say, patterns that the daughter of a still here mother, and I don't have children of my own either, but in thinking about what it would be to raise a daughter, because it's not impossible, what healing can I do with that person now while they're here, whether it's things like shame, like, you know, I don't know what the specifics all may be, but certainly like addiction.
Yeah.
You know, if you've had a parent that's come through, a mother that's come through that, then, and it's something that you recognize too in yourself to have those kinds of conversations, and what can I learn to then like pass on to my own daughter, or, you know, I'm sure so many other things we pass down like invisibly, don't we?
Absolutely. Let's speak about that, because I think it's so relevant and so important, especially in the world of healing, right? So we have this intergenerational experience of dysfunction that gets passed along. We also have positive things that get passed along, right? There's legacies to both. But if we don't heal that, what tends to happen is that they get buried, they get blocked, they get expressed in various ways that are unhealthy in our relationships. Like, this becomes a taboo subject, or this becomes a taboo subject. You know, let's say in the realms of sex, right? Sex and love. So let's say your own mother was shamed completely. Maybe she was thrown a book on, you know, reading on how to have sex or what sex even means and move on. And no one talked about birth control or anything like that. That daughter may grow up and say, well, I'm not going to do that to my child. And then they do the pendulum swing. And the pendulum swing is, I'm in your face. I'm going to talk to you about everything. I'm never going to let it go. I want to know. I want to look at your vagina. I want to see what it looks like. I want to tell you the parts of it, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which can be then too much. And then often what happens is then that daughter comes up and goes, whoa, that was too much. I'm not going to do that. Let's take, you know, we're always trying to find that middle ground. So that's what makes it so challenging to be a parent. Just when we think we get it right, we get it wrong. I used to tell my daughter when she was growing up, don't worry, honey, I have a college fund and a therapy fund for you, because we just don't know which one you're going to need more. So it is one of those things that, if, like with your mom, and what I talk about in the book is really about, you know, it's not just that daughters can be sassy toward their moms. Moms can be unknowingly sassy and rude toward their daughters as well, by not being able to communicate in a way that really is a good match for your own child. So one of the things that I think is really relevant and important is how to learn how to have a dialogue with that person who's in front of you. Jeremy, as you were saying earlier, what may traumatize one may be nothing to another, because we all have our different levels of resiliency and in different areas. So you can, you know, throw a stone at one child who goes, okay, let's play catch. And another child's like, I'm bruised, I'm wounded, I don't trust you, my life is ruined. So it's so important, I believe, that you talk to your mom and you say, hey, mom, well, you got any bones to pick with me? And here's what I'd like to work out with you. And I can give you lots of exercises. I call them sugar and spice exercises, how you build that healing tree, so that you can have the seeds to grow something that's even a bigger and stronger and better tree that the two of you can work together when you actually have kids, that you're not fighting up against that which says, I don't want to be like my mom in that area. Well, maybe you do to some degree and maybe you don't, but it's got to be a conscious decision. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
Absolutely. One thing I'm curious about, and again, just to that point of like, I think sometimes people don't necessarily know what those things could be or what to look for when maybe thinking about, you know, their relationship that they had with their mother. What are some like red flags that people could sort of look for or perhaps like red flags that maybe sometimes kind of go under the radar that people don't quite notice when it comes to, you know, thinking about having this sort of conversation with a parent to unearth the potential of some sort of hurt or wrongdoing or, you know, something to mend?
Good question. One of the things I really don't address significantly in the book is if somebody has a parent with personality disorder, like narcissistic personality disorder or borderline personality disorder, because that's a whole other realm. In fact, trying to address something with somebody in that situation, or if the daughter has that, it's almost fruitless unless you have a professional who can help you with that, because it's just often too triggering. But let's say you have the run-of-the-mill, too nice mom who's doing her best, who you know loves you, and you know that you love your daughter and you want to make things right, but you're just defensive and you don't know what's going on exactly. So if there have been significant shifts in the relationship, for example, let's say at one point you were very close together. I have several examples in the book of, you know, a mother and daughter who love to go shopping together and do their girl stuff and have fun. And then the daughter gets into different interests and the mom is not on board with being accepting of those, that freedom and independence that the daughter might be choosing, and maybe becomes more judgmental, maybe becomes more hostile. And then the daughter starts pulling away because she's saying, "Mom, I'm sorry, I love doing that with you when I was 10, but not when I'm 16. And certainly not now when I'm 24 and I've got my own busy life to take care of and I've got a job and I've got, you know, the potential of a promotion, et cetera, et cetera." So it's when there's been a significant shift in the relationship, that's a great time to say, "Hey, I noticed that something's changed. And you know what? I really want to be open to understanding my part in that." So a really big premise of this book is it's not about the blame shame game. We don't want to do that. Blame and shame and attack and making someone wrong doesn't get us anywhere. What we want to do is open up our own hearts to being self-loving and compassionate, knowing that we made a mistake, acknowledging what those mistakes are, taking responsibility for them, and inviting our daughters to share with us that which they hear us say, to understand that, and then asking at some point, "Hey, are you willing to hear what my experience is of you?" So it's kind of a reciprocal thing. I really hope that daughters take a liking to this book as much as moms, because it really is for both.
In terms of just thinking about like having these sorts of conversations, how do like power dynamics play a role in all of this? You know, like especially when dealing with two adults, you know, I think back to a time where I had a bit of a, not a falling out, but like I had a rough patch with my dad, and approaching him to have conversations about those sorts of things, I think there was like maybe a bit of a block there because I spent so much of my life looking at my dad as like my authority figure and almost like preventing me from having this, like, I don't know, ability or stance to really stand my ground and feel confident in saying what it was that I was thinking or going through. So like, do you, you know, in working with past clients and even doing work through the book, like, Has the role of power dynamics kind of played into any of this work?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's really important to have a fluid definition of what it means to be a parent. Mm-hmm. So our role as a parent changes as our children grow up and become more independent. So yes, we always remain a parent. That's just a label that we attach to the person who raised the child. You're still a parent. However, who you may have been when your child was 5 or 10 or 15 or even 20 is going to be very different than the role that you would want to have with them when they have their own families, when they have their own lives, and they're actually independent. Now, there's a little bit of a caveat I'll say about there are some children who fail to launch, or they've launched and now they come back home and they're much needier maybe at that time, or much more dependent again. And then it's very common for people to go back into that regressive role of being the, "I am the authority." But by and large, if your child is pretty much adult and taking care of themselves, you want to, as the parent, let go of that need to be the authority, need to be the one in charge, and instead be much more open to a reciprocal, inviting relationship that says, hey, you know, if you'd like my opinion, I have some experience in this department. I'd be happy to share it, but I'm not going to thrust it upon you. I'm not going to force it upon you because that's not my job anymore.
Turn Me On Podcast. We'll be back after this short break.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, to get 30, to get 20, 20, 20, to get 20, 20, to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
That's just an interesting perspective, because thinking about, I think what you were just saying is what was it really addressed to the mothers in the situation of opening yourself up to as your adult child, as an adult, an independent person on their own. But it's a similar thing as the child of a parent, even though I'm an adult, still a child of a parent, feeling like my parent should be the adult in the situation. And they should, you know, whatever, blank, blank, blank. In my case, they should be the ones to call me. I'm their daughter. They should call me, yeah, check in on me.
That's a great point. Oh my gosh, I love this one. I love this one. Go ahead. I don't want to interrupt. I don't want to step on you there.
I feel like you know where I'm going, but from the younger's perspective, looking up and being like, how do I, you know, that for me could just be, that might be like, I'm expressing a boundary, I guess, in a way, which is just like, I want a reciprocal relationship. So, you know, you call me sometimes, I call you sometimes, or, you know, just, I guess, getting around the shoulds of what a parent should be as an adult. And then how do you even fucking start? Do you even bother? Do you like, because you can be peaceful with your relationship with your dad at the same time. Like, yeah, you said, you don't feel like you need to go heal that necessarily. You know, you can accept that there's parts of a relationship that hurt or have pain associated to them without the desire to like, I have to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, mm-hmm. Continue.
So on all levels, as human beings, we have expectations, whether we want to face them or not. And as some people will say, I think this came from 12-step programs, expectations are resentments under construction. Hmm. And resentments are like swallowing poison and waiting for the other guy to die. So expectations, I talk about them as reasonable expectations that are known and conscious. And then those are those unreasonable expectations that are generally unconscious, or they could be conscious, but they're definitely unreasonable. So again, just as our roles as parents and children change as we grow through the life cycle, so should our, that's the one should I will say, should, so should our expectations evolve and change, because what was fitting when somebody's 5 is not fitting when they're 25. And when you bring up this concept of who's to call whom as you get older, it's such a fascinating thing to me, because my dad, having been a Holocaust survivor, was terrified of loss and abandonment. Yeah. And he literally had this concept that his two daughters had to call him every day, every day for the rest of his life. And there was no budging on that. There was no work around that. And every time I would miss a day, he would say, you don't love me. You never call me. And I would say, Dad, I love you, and I called you 364 days this year, but it's always that one that I didn't. Mm. And over time, where I really begrudged that, especially when I was in my on fire independence phase, like, I don't want to be told what to do. And then I finally looked at that situation and said, gosh, my dad is just in terror. He's never gonna solve or heal that terror that he has. I'll just go with it, because thank God he had the attention span of a gnat. So the conversation only needed to be 20 seconds or so. He's not here anymore. And I miss him terribly. But it's that concept of, you know, really become conscious of what those expectations are. So somebody else once said, and I love this saying, you know, you've really grown up when you can do what your mother or father asks you to do anyway. So you're no longer in that, coming back to you, Jeremy, that power struggle, that sense of like, can't do that, or I have to have this for my own independence. And what creates that? What creates that is a compassionate, fertile ground of love, appreciation, openness, open-heartedness between those family members involved, so that that communication and that dialogue can really become much more expressive and real.
You mentioned something earlier, too, like moms being too nice, or too nice mom syndrome. What is that?
Yeah. So the too nice syndrome is really this concept of, I will do everything. I will have no boundaries. My daughter is the most important person on the planet, and I will give way to all of my own needs and boundaries to be there for her. Oftentimes at the expense of myself, giving out too much, being a hostage to my own resentments that are unconscious, that I don't speak to, that I don't talk about. So my own behavior may actually become not very nice to the daughter. She may be perceiving me as being the rude one, or why is she such a bitch, even though I think I'm going overboard, because that can cause a lot of problems. So boundaries are just as important. Boundaries, limits with love are just as important as being open-minded and giving to one's child. And especially as one's child grows up. So being able to kind of pull back a little bit and let that unfold by being honest, real, and genuine. Because as I said a little earlier, too nice really means pretending not to know. And when we put our head in the sand, I have a really funny story for you on this one. When my daughter was 4 years old and we were at a supermarket, and there was a man standing in line, and my daughter leans over. She says to me, she goes, "Mommy," as she's pointing to this man, "That's the biggest nose I've ever seen." And I took a gulp and I said, "Oh boy, I wonder how this one's going to turn out." And at this point, I'm very conscious of shame and, you know, not wanting to shame her. And she's just being a little girl whose eyes lit up because she saw, you know, a beautiful red apple that she's never seen the brightness of an apple before. Mm-hmm. There had no judgment behind it, simply an observation and a statement of what she observed. This gentleman was the nicest, the kindest, I will say, person on the planet, because maybe he was being nice and pretended not to know. But he leans into her and he says, "I know. Would you like to touch it?" And she leans over and she's touching his nose. And it's the cutest thing ever. And I'm like, oh, thank goodness. You know, this man isn't going to punch me in the face or tell me, what kind of mother are you that you would allow your daughter? And I know other people around are looking at this scenario like, what is going to happen? Yeah. But we went along that one unscathed. She never felt worse for the wear. He was perfectly happy. I said, "Thank you so much for being so kind." And we all went about our day. But there was a great example of, I could have said to her as we were walking out, "Don't say things like that. That's not nice." Really, I think it's better that we work on kindness rather than, I mean, look, no one's going to give up the word nice, but really think about that, what it means when you're telling someone, be nice, be nice.
Do you remember what the follow-up was? Like, what you did say to her after, you know, after you guys left or that man walked away? Was there any kind of, like, how would you approach that in order to, you know, save her from feeling any shame, but also, you know, informing her that, like, hey, you know, like, maybe don't point out the giant nose next time you see it.
I'm pretty sure I didn't go that direction at that moment because it went so smoothly. Yeah. My guess is, in hindsight, had he said something that was, I mean, of course, the life lessons along the way were such that we do have to be conscientious about what we say to other people, because some people are very sensitive. And I would try to teach empathy, like, Tiffany, you are also quite a sensitive little girl, and some things are going to push our buttons more than others. And you know, so over time, understanding the self-consciousness that people have around body shaming, around all kinds of things that we deal with. But at the time, I think it was just a, you know, that was just a good one and done.
Yeah.
Let's just let that go and let it be. And I think we just moved on. I probably said something like, oh, well, there was an interesting moment or something, but you know, there was no trauma in it. And I was very happy for it.
In talking about the too nice syndrome, you know, one of the things you said was finding a time where you have to realize like that it's time to pull back a little bit and not show up that way that you've typically been showing up. And I can imagine when I hear you say that, I think of my mom and think about how that must be a hard thing to do for a lot of mothers to be able to pull back and not show up for your daughter in the ways that you did when they were five, doing that the exact same way that you are now that they're 25. What are some like suggestions for parents who, mothers specifically, who have a hard time swallowing that pill of like not being in that position?
Well, the premise of the book in a large way is that most of the too nice moms that I describe in the book are those who really felt some of that woundedness that I felt, let's say, as a child, who really wanted to be loved and to be loving and to just not make those same mistakes and to provide a different climate, a different sense of unitedness and closeness. And so it came from a really good place. But as you're saying, which is really important, is as a child grows, they need to have their independence. There's a whole developmental process called separation individuation that is so critical to becoming one's own person, which is not that, you know, now I'm no longer part of your body anymore once I've been born, but I still want to be physically close to you, but I'm also not not the same person as you. That's that individuation, my own identity. We need to allow our children as they grow up to have that, both our sons and our daughters. And what for moms, a lot of times, because they may have been the primary nurturer to some degree, and I'm stereotyping here, I know that's changed a lot in different cultures, but in many cultures, that is still true, or that's still been the role, or as the secondary earner in the family, because still not being able to make as much maybe as a man can make for the same job. So it's oftentimes they have more of the childcare as well. So as the daughter is growing up, being able to step back a little bit. Don't have to be that nervous Nelly all the time. Don't have to be the perfectionist and making sure that everything is just right for your child and yourself so that they don't have to suffer any consequences or feel any pain in life. It's okay. Children are resilient. They do grow up. They need to have their own disappointments. They need to have their own learning experiences. So for moms, the best advice I have on that is get real with yourself about what else you need in life. Because you probably have let a lot of your own self-centered needs fall through the wayside. So pick up a hobby, advance your career, get into some kind of volunteer that you've always wanted to do, get into the arts, get creative, do something maybe that you've been longing to do, that you put all that energy into your child. But you have to get over that fear of not being loved. Because if you've done a good job, by and large, even if your daughter is being a bitch or she's being sassy and rude and rolling her eyes at you, she still loves you, because otherwise she'd be indifferent and she'd pull away completely. So if you're even having any sort of contentiousness with your child, it means she's still in the game with you. And she's still in the process. You just have to find a different language of love to communicate.
Yeah, that you were just speaking about the amount of time that you're spending with and around and in service to that relationship dropping off. I was listening to a podcast the other day about the stats that like the most time you're going to spend with your family in your whole life, the time in your life where you're going to be spending the most amount of your time with your family is before the age of 18. And then it steeply, steeply drops off.
Right.
And by the time you hit 24, this is what the stats were saying, it's pretty much plateaued. The amount of time that you're spending with your family at that point in your life becomes basically the most amount of time in your life that you will, unless you're making conscious intentional efforts to just spend more time, or maybe you become a intergenerational household or something like mm-hmm. that. But just something to think about, as you know, that's a huge shift in relationship, the leaving home and like flying the nest. And we've talked a lot about your mom's experience with empty nest syndrome, and
yeah,
just like that loss of role, of service that you have. But the quality time, I think, is what when you're talking about that mom, is what I feel like that mom probably misses. Is like, yeah. I'm also just like not as in proximity to this person that yeah. I want to be.
And I think in many ways it's hardest for moms who were more of the caregiver at home and who maybe didn't have a work life outside, mm-hmm. and her primary function and role was to serve her children and to be there, and you know, the soccer mom that take it to all the games and be there for every component of their lives. And they're oftentimes, again, unconscious expectations, seeking this level of appreciation and gratitude that often doesn't come in the form that they're looking for it, right? I mean, your child's job is not to endlessly say, "Mom, you're a saint. Thank goodness. Oh my God, I could never do without you." They're just doing their own thing and oftentimes taking that for granted. Mm-hmm. So you want to be careful to have that balance. And it's hardest in that empty nest if you then find yourself literally with that empty nest. I have to say, that was really the decline for my mom. As much as I don't think she really wanted to be a mom, that was her life. And as my sister left the house and I left the house and we were never to return other than for family dinners now and again, she got lost. She got lost. She got very depressed. She had very poor self-care. And I kept trying to reach out, "Mom, let me help you. Let me help you." And she just said, "You're the worst daughter on the planet." And we never got to have. And then a week later, she died of multi-system failure function. So it was a pain in my heart that was so terrible. And I've like vowed at that time, I'm never going to lay that type of trip on my daughter. Now, believe me, I made a ton of mistakes, and we've had our goes, and it's a never ending healing process, but it's hard work. It's really hard, but it can also be so fulfilling and really a lot of fun when you feel like you have the tools and the treasure chest of goodies that you can apply instead of just winging it.
Yeah.
Do you have any like real life examples of mother-daughter dynamics that sort of had a pretty transformative shift using the methods that are in your book?
I do, and I do speak to those in multiple different examples in the book, but just one that comes to mind at this moment is a mom who was a single mom, and they came to me when the daughter was she had launched and then had to unlaunch or come back home to the pad. And it was the two of them living alone. Now, the first part of it, living together, I'm sorry, without the dad wasn't really much in the picture. And they, at first, it was like a honeymoon period. Yeah, they were both so excited to be, "Oh my God, I have my mom all to myself, whatever I want to do. And oh my God, we get to go shopping all the time." And mom was, you know, very active. They did a lot of trips together and physicalness, et cetera. But then the mom was just in her face all the time, like, "Who are you dating? Why are you dating that person?" She had envy. She had jealousy. She was really feeling like, wow, my daughter had become my partner, because the mom wasn't really interested in dating again and didn't really trust relationships much. So her daughter became everything to her again. Mm-hmm. And it was quite inappropriate. And so first the mom came, and then I said, "You got to bring the daughter in, because we got to do some mother-daughter work here, because that's the only way out of this." And it was an intense process, you know, a lot of tears, a lot of crying, a lot of upsets, a lot of letting go, but a lot of dialogue about what it meant to be loving to each other, what it meant to actually have a different language of love. And also the daughter needed to learn how to stop regressing, because one of the things that she did was leave her room untidy and leave things all over the house. And, you know, the mom said, "You know what, I'm not your maid." And so they had a lot of resentments with that. And so my job was to help the daughter step up. You want to be here? You still have to be an adult. You don't get to fall back into being a 5-year-old or a 15-year-old where your mom took care of everything. And mom, you need to go get a life. You need to go out with friends. You need to do stuff. And you cannot be there sitting idle waiting for your daughter if she comes home at 10:05 when she said she'd be home at 10. So it was a big challenge for both of them, to the end where, last I heard, they still take an occasional trip together and go someplace in Kilimanjaro or someplace. And they're doing well. And then I believe the daughter has moved into a relationship herself. And I think the mom's dating as well. So all in all, I think it was a good success story.
I love that.
So obviously we like to talk about sex on the show. And one thing I don't know if we've touched on yet in this conversation, and I know we're coming up soon to time, but I'm really curious about, we kind of talked about handing things down and passing things on, but with regards to women and their sexuality or raising a daughter that has that confidence to be independent, but also, you know, the intelligence, whatever it takes to creativity, whatever leads you to that place where you feel, you know, empowered about your sexuality, like what is that transfer of information back and forth between a mother and a daughter, coming of age, learning about sexuality, expressing that in the world however we can?
That's great. I think the first couple steps are that mom has to get really clear about what her own hangups are about sexuality. Mm-hmm. And she has to be really sensitive to the kind of body image that she carries around and self-image that she carries around, because mm-hmm. the daughters definitely do learn the most about their own body image through their moms. So you can have a mom who says, oh, honey, you're beautiful, and the mom's on a diet every day, always losing weight, always trying some new fad, always getting plastic surgery, and really basically telling the daughter, you're not okay as you are. I can tell you that, but this not what's so. And that can so much interfere with a daughter's self-concept about who she is as a woman and what she's about. So you really want to deal with body positivity and really dealing with yourself as well. So healing one's own wounds in that area is really important. And having an open dialogue, being able to talk to your daughter about what are her questions, give her an open forum, say, look, whatever it is, I'm not going to judge you. And you have to be careful then not to judge. Because that's it. We can often say, I'm not going to judge you. And yet we're going, but why would you do, you know? So you have to be very mindful of that. But to be able to have those comments and save your judgments and tell her this for when you really believe that she's in danger, because it is your job still. It's a parent's job always to try to protect their children from real danger out there. But a lot of the things that we think are dangerous is really just about her own exploration. So that is a big question that I wish we did have more time to talk about, because it's so multifaceted. But it's a very meaningful question and something that moms and daughters need to be conscious about. And I'm telling daughters too, you know what? Your mom has some wisdom. So if you're listening to this and, you know, and you have a mom who's around, go talk to your mom about this stuff. Go tell her what it is that you wish that she had talked to you about, what she didn't talk to you about, what you wanted to talk to you about now. Why not? This gets to go both ways.
Would you feel comfortable telling your daughter if you didn't like their boyfriend?
I feel like that
would be a tough one.
It's a tough one. And I've tried to present it as, look, I can appreciate that we all get to have who we fall in love with. And, but there may be some concerns that I have. Mm. So I would talk about it as concerns as opposed to, I just don't like someone. Because a lot of people, I didn't like some of her friends, but they were great friends to her. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's my personality is obviously triggering something in me. So it's really not about like or dislike. It's more about when I observe this, this is what I interpret it to mean, and this is how I feel about it. Mm. So it's kind of a conversation piece that kind of keeps it out of that judgment and more about, look, I know this is my interpretation, and you may have contrary information. Now, that's different if, let's say, my 15-year-old were out dating somebody who was I knew was a serial killer.
Mm-hmm. I hope so. Yeah, right?
Mm-hmm. This would be a different scenario than, you know, somebody who maybe lives a lifestyle that I'm not necessarily comfortable with.
Right. Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that would be a tough one. That's
right. I always think about like those parents who are like their parent, they're watching their kids getting married to someone that they don't like. Like you hear that sometimes and you're like, did you say anything? How did that conversation go? But I think the way that you've just described it is like, when it's like, I'm observing this, I feel this way, I own that this is my perception on this.
Yeah.
It just kind of invites a conversation. And I feel like if I was the recipient of a parent coming and saying that to me, I'd be like, I would feel, you know, I would be glad to know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That someone sees that, just in case there was something in my mind that was, you know, doubtful, or does anyone else see this? Or maybe like, what? I don't know. There's just so many possibilities. What are my blind spots? You know, but I think it'd be good to know.
Yeah, I think the first question is, why do not like this person? Is it really something about you? Is it something that you're just uncomfortable with? Or are you really noticing some things that are outside of what you believe is also your child's value system, your adult child's value system? Mm. Boy, I got to tell you, on a friend level, I was with a sociopath for years that I didn't realize for after a couple of years, and I couldn't get out. And it was a horrifying situation. And my friends didn't say anything. And when I finally got out, they're like, oh my God, we couldn't stand the guy. Hated the guy. And we're so good. Why didn't you say something? Something, you know, because people dance on. It's again that being nice, right? Pretending not to know. I don't want to trample on somebody's territory. But I think that's why if you say something, you just want to say it in a way that's kind and thoughtful and mindful and understand the motives.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank God all my past partners' parents love me. I don't know what I would do.
Yeah, that's true.
Dr. Deborah, this has been an absolute delight. How can people find the book? How can people find you and keep up to date with the work that you are doing and continue to do?
Okay, well, it is Sassy and Rude, her new attitude. And it's I just really cherish it. I'm glad that I had the opportunity to write it. It is available online at your available bookseller. So Amazon.com, BarnesandNoble.com. People can find me at my website, drdebraonline.com, drdebraonline.com. I'm a little outdated here. I know I have all my social media on there, so you can click on that. But for me to tell you what my handles are and all that stuff, I'm not going to do it. So I should have like a little card that I should post here.
We could roll some.
There you go.
Well, we'll include all the links in the show notes. And again, Deborah, this has been just an absolute treat. Thank you so much for taking time into your schedule to sit down and chat with us.
Such a pleasure. I appreciate it. You two are the greatest hosts. I had so much fun.
All right, there we have it, folks. Hope you enjoyed that conversation that we just had. And thanks for listening to the podcast. If you want to support the podcast further, you can do that by leaving a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, or you can simply rate the podcast on the Spotify mobile app. And if you want to support the podcast even further than that, which you can.
Wow.
You can go to
so kind and thoughtful and so generous. Thoughtful,
so generous. Go to patreon.com/turnmeon to become a patron and help us keep this podcast afloat.
Well, if you want to reach out to us, turnmeonpodcast@gmail.com is always open for all of your messages. That's the best way to get in touch. If you have a question for us, if you'd like to be a guest on the show, if you have a recommendation for a guest on the show, or if you just want to send us a little love note, email, money transfer, all of that.
Sex toy.
You know, we're our email inbox is open to you.
That is it for this week. Until next week.
Why don't you go touch yourself?